This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For several years, it looked as though New Hampshire was making headway against homelessness. But now that progress appears to have stalled, according to a new report. The causes vary from economic hardship to struggles with substance abuse and mental illness, but there are some common themes. A tight and expensive rental market tops the list, and though the economy has improved overall, some juggle part-time jobs that don't add up to stability or adequate income. There's debate over what works best when it comes to reducing homelessness, particularly as a long-term solution. Some argue that permanent housing should come first, before sobriety, for instance. Others feel a home or apartment should come only after a person meets certain requirements. And by the way, all of this is easier said than done when the cost of rental housing is soaring. Today in The Exchange, handling homelessness in New Hampshire, where the conversation is now and what's changing, let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We begin the hour with Kathy Kuhn, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness. Kathy, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Just a couple quick questions for you, Kathy, please. On your 2015 report, you say there was progression and regression over this past year. Let's take the progress first. What did you find, Kathy?
Yeah, so we did see some progress. We saw some significant decreases in some of our key subpopulations of the homeless. So a big one that we saw was a decrease in our unsheltered homeless population. Obviously, that's very, very important. That's a critical population. It's folks who are on the street are very, very vulnerable. Lots of sickness, lots of challenges there. And so that is a very positive sign that we were able to reduce that number and get those folks off the streets. We also saw decreases among our homeless veterans. And there's also been, sort of a huge push to get any unsheltered veteran off the street. We've had lots of investment from some federal resources to provide permanent housing to any homeless veteran. And so we're seeing that those efforts are really starting to show in terms of our homeless numbers. And then we also saw some decreases in our chronically homeless population. So these are folks who have been homeless for, very long periods of time or who have had repeated episodes of homeless. Again, extremely, extremely vulnerable population and one that we obviously want to really try to target resources to in order to get them off the street. So those were really, really good signs of progress in the state.
What's the difference, Kathy, between unsheltered and homeless? Because to some people, it may sound like the same thing.
Yeah, so we when we do this point in time count, we do sort of two separate things. One is what we call an unsheltered count. So that is where we go out and try to count anyone who's living in a place not meant for human habitation. So the streets, the shelters, their cars, their camps, whatever it might be. But then we also have a sheltered homeless population. And so those are folks who are living in emergency shelters. They might be living in sort of a shorter-term transitional living program, but they're still considered homeless because they do not have, a permanent place to live. So those numbers, are captured in what we report to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I will say, however, that number does not include people who are doubled up and couch surfing. And many people argue that number really should be included in our overall counts of homelessness because those folks are clearly, struggling just as much as anyone who's in an emergency shelter. There's lots of stress, you know, when folks are going from house to house and couch to couch and really not knowing where they're going to spend the night.
You also do write, Kathy, that after 2 years of measurable decline in the overall number of Granite Staters without a permanent roof over their heads, in 2015 that progress did stall, to use your words. Why do you think that's the case?
It stalled. It did. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different, you know, reasons for that. You mentioned some of them. Certainly, you know, we need to get better connection to mental health care, substance use services, those sorts of things. But ultimately, you know, in my mind, the real reason is that we have a huge lack of affordable housing in our state. And you know, we're not the only ones. New Hampshire isn't the only one that's struggling with this issue. This is something that is happening across the country. But there is, you know, the vacancy rate in New Hampshire is 2%, sometimes less than 2% in some areas. And that is just extremely, alarmingly low. It's really a landlord's market out there. And so, you know, landlords can really choose who they want to go into their units. And oftentimes, folks who have become homeless may not have the best rental history. Those are the folks that, you know, become the last served and the, you know, the least likely to go into a permanent housing situation. I mean, the other thing, of course, is just the affordability of it, and that, you know, these are folks who are very low or on fixed incomes, and there is truly no place in the state where someone can afford, you know, a permanent housing unit on a fixed income unless you have a permanent house or a subsidy, some sort of subsidy to go along with that. And as we know, those subsidies are very, very rare in our state. The waiting list is, you know, eight years, sometimes longer in some areas of the state to access one of those subsidies. So it doesn't leave a whole lot of resources for families and individuals in need.
Kathy, I was kind of surprised that, you know, that progress has stalled, as you said, given that the unemployment rate, both nationally and especially in New Hampshire, is pretty low, 3% about here in the Granite State.
It is, but you know what? We have to look at the types of jobs that folks are getting. And these are folks that, you know, sometimes don't have a lot of skill. And so, you know, when they're making, you know, when they do work, and many of them do, they're often making $7.25 an hour, the minimum wage. And again, there is simply no place in the state where someone making minimum wage is going to be able to afford a permanent housing. Someone would have to work, you know, over 100 hours a week in order to afford permanent housing, making the minimum wage. So, the unemployment rate is low, and that is great, but we need to look at the types of jobs that that folks are getting. And these are folks, like I said, that, you know, in some cases don't have a lot of education, don't have a lot of work history, don't have a lot of skills, and so really need that support to be able to get into a higher paying job that's going to be able to allow them, you know, to afford housing.
Well, last question for you, Kathy, please. How does this 2015 report that you've been describing help guide your efforts in 2016?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we did see in this report was that there was an increase in the number of families with children, and that's something that's very concerning to us. You know, there's been a lot of resources sort of directed to the chronically homeless population, veterans homelessness, and, you know, not as much really focusing on families with children. And so, you know, that's something that we feel we need to watch very closely and really pay attention to and try to work in all of our communities to make sure that those families with children are getting the resources that they need, because certainly we know that there can be a generational cycle to homelessness, and what we want to do is try to prevent that from happening as much as we can.
Well, Kathy, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're quite welcome, Laura. Thank you.
That's Kathy Kuhn, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness. And that's what we're talking about today in the exchange, handling homelessness, how some Granite State communities are grappling with this, about the different types of solutions, including the conversation now about housing first. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests in studio. Susan Ford is here, Executive Director of the Homeless Center for Stratford County. And Susan, it's nice to meet you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Ellen Groh, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition to End Homelessness. Ellen, good to meet you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Keith Howard, Executive Director of Liberty House, which serves veterans. Keith, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And also with us, Scott Slattery, Housing Director for Harbor Homes, a nonprofit that provides a range of services statewide. And Scott, welcome. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, I'll turn to you first, Scott, since you guys are working around the state. What do you pull from that report that we just heard from Kathy Kuhn about?
I couldn't have said it better than what Kathy had said. I know there's been a multitude of resources put to specific segments of the homeless population, but I think the lack of opportunity for families with children is one of the biggest issues that we're facing right now. We're working a lot around the table with chronically homeless folks, as well as veterans and other subpopulations. But the lack of opportunity for families with children is definitely one of the biggest concerns that we have.
Why is it important to look at these subpopulations? Kathy mentioned that too, you know, veterans versus chronically versus families and so forth.
And a lot of it boils down to funding. I mean, a lot of times the federal government has priorities that they set forth down to agencies like ours and how they would like us to address the issue. Right now and over the last year, one of the main focuses has been on chronically homeless persons and chronically homeless veterans. That's been two of the main priorities that our organization has been undertaking, trying to get people into permanent housing as quickly as we possibly can.
Susan, I want to ask you the same question I asked Kathy about the economy. It is getting better. Unemployment is low. I wonder how you kind of put that together with the people that you work with.
Well, oftentimes what we see is exactly that. The employment rate seems to be going down, but most of my families are, if they're working, they're working very part-time jobs with no benefits, no way to make anywhere near fair market rent. And there's a transportation issue. They don't make enough money to even buy a car. So they're stuck in those part-time jobs that are within their local area that they can walk back and forth. So it's really hard to kind of manage all of that and get to where you need to be without a vehicle.
What are you hearing from people who come into your shelter about just how they got there and you know, their hopes for getting out?
Well, some of the stories aren't unlike my own, but a lot of them got there because that's where they've been their whole life. They grew up in this. They don't know anything different. They're very disheartened. It's very hard to get them, a lot of them, to buy into that you could have something different. You really could. To sacrifice a little bit more of what you already have, to work hard, to go back to school. But again, it's hard to buy into that when you don't have transportation, you know, when you have three kids. How are you going to get back and forth to school? How are you going to work during the day, get your kids home from daycare? It's really hard to imagine. Take your car away and figure out how you would do your life without your vehicle.
Well, and the daily struggles are probably exhausting, so it's hard to move that next step.
It sure is.
You mentioned your own story, so I'm going to have to ask you to tell us that you know, not only are executive director, again, of the Homeless Center for Stratford County, but you're coming at this with a personal experience.
I am. I found myself homeless with two young children at the ripe old age of 24. And I spent 5 months at my friend's place in Dover. And I was very, very lucky. I had no family in the area, but I ended up having a role model. And I was, I think probably the key factor for me is that I was morbidly embarrassed about my situation. I really hated going to any social service and asking for help. It thoroughly embarrassed me. And I was angry about that. And I was so angry that I insisted that that was not going to be me anymore. So I went back to work. I went to school. I was very fortunate. There was transitional housing then. There was wait lists that were prioritized. So I was in public assisted housing within a very short time. Those wait list prioritizations are gone now. So it's 2 years to get into a public assisted housing. Shelters can't take people for 2 years. We're a seasonal shelter. We certainly can't take people for 2 years. I guess I was lucky in the fact that it was the time that I was homeless. It's a lot harder now for folks. But I went back to school. I own my own home now. And I'm, of course, working in this line of work because I'm passionate about it. Because I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not the exception to the rule. Anybody can do what I've done. They just have to really work hard, and unfortunately now harder because the support services really aren't there like they were 20 years ago.
Keith, I know you have your own story, and maybe you'll share that with us in a moment, but Kathy Kuhn also told us that there has been some progress towards getting American veterans off the street. That's a group you work with. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, there's a concept called functional zero that New Hampshire and Harbor Homes in particular have been trying to reach, which is a little bit complicated. But if you think about the plague, right now in the United States each year, there are about a dozen cases of the plague. But what happens is as soon as people walk into the emergency room, get diagnosed, they're put on antibiotics, and then they're cured. So we've achieved functional zero with the plague. The goal of achieving functional zero for veterans' homelessness is the same thing. There will always be people who are out of homes, but that when they walk into, whether it's Harbor Homes or Liberty House or wherever, that there will be the assistance available to them so that their period of being homelessness will be really short. And Michelle Obama in particular has made it a goal that veterans' homelessness be – she had said she wanted to have it ended by December 31st of last year. That has not been achieved, but huge strides are being made in New Hampshire in terms of reducing veteran homelessness.
So you are seeing some of the progress that Kathy – talked
yes.
about among
yes.
veterans.
Yes. The problem that we're seeing is that folks are able to get into a place, but then unless they change their behaviors, the behaviors that got them homeless in the first place tend to get them back homeless again. You know, whether you're talking about staying up all night being loud, whether you're talking about drug and alcohol abuse, whether you're talking about having all of your friends come over to couch surf at your place, those are all things that will get you kicked out of even the most liberal landlord's place.
And we will talk about the different types of shelters, too, and housing and the different requirements. Some are more lenient than others. Before I get to you, Ellen Groh, an email just came in that I do want to throw at you, Keith. This person did not want to give a name. Due to a perfect storm of misfortunate events that occurred in December 2014, I stayed 1 week at the Crossroads Homeless Shelter in Portsmouth. During those 7 days, this person says, I came to realize that the majority of individuals at the Crossroads Shelter were there because of substance abuse. And as you might expect, the substances most commonly abused were opioids. However, to my surprise, I discovered alcohol abuse is also a large contributor to homelessness. I want to thank this person for sending in the email. And Keith, that's what tripped you up.
Well, it is. It is. And I lived on the streets. It's been 8.5 years now. But when I was living on the streets, it was because of alcoholism, untreated alcoholism, so that at the end I was stealing mouthwash from dollar stores to drink. I was lucky enough as a veteran to be able to walk into the VA hospital in Manchester and say, hi, my name's Keith Howard, and I don't really want to be alive anymore. And immediately the resources of the United States government were brought to bear so that I was introduced to a program of recovery that's still central to my life right now. And I just – it's a certain irony here. Just yesterday in the Union Leader, we had an op-ed piece about how Liberty House has, effective January 1st, walked away from all federal funding because of this very issue of drug and alcohol use. Under Housing First, which has a lot to recommend it, it's a philosophy that says that if somebody's homeless, they should be given a home right away, or they should have a home right away. One of the requirements of a Housing First model, though, is that you not mandate any kind of treatment, that you not keep people from using drugs and alcohol. Because of my experience and because of the experience at Liberty House, we feel very strongly that a zero tolerance policy is necessary. Because of that, we've walked away from all federal money. I've taken a 50% cut in pay until that money is made up.
$40,000 from
yes.
what I understand. We'll talk more about Housing First in just a moment and a lot more. And Ellen, I'll go to you as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at how communities are handling homelessness in the Granite State and some of the conversations around policies and solutions. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Keith Howard is here, Executive Director of Liberty House, which serves veterans, along with Scott Slattery, Housing Director for Harbor Homes, a nonprofit that works statewide, providing a range of services, Susan Ford, Executive Director of the Homeless Center for Stratford County, and Ellen Groh, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition to End Homelessness. And Ellen, I did want to go to you now and talk a little bit about what's been happening in Concord, because it's been a big conversation and it also has possible impacts as other communities look at this. So just remind us sort of where we are at right now here in the capital city.
Thanks, Laura. Well, where we're at, we've just been through a pretty stressful, challenging time, if anyone's been reading the paper. There were two churches, South Congregational Church and First Congregational Church, who for over 10 years ran what we call low-barrier shelters. They would during the winter, just during the winter, and they would accept anyone, whether they had an active addiction or not. You could show up basically intoxicated, and as long as you didn't cause any problems, you could stay there. And after 10 years, they both said, we can't continue to shoulder this burden anymore. They wanted to be part of the solution, but they couldn't host the shelters any longer. So we, as the coalition, we started bringing together different providers to see if we could locate another site and another agency to run such a shelter in the winter. But we were not able to locate anyone. And as the time got closer and closer and people were feeling the panic of it, I will say the city came together in an amazing way. And I have to credit Mayor Boulay especially for negotiating a temporary situation for this winter. So St. Peter's offered their activity center. That site is for sale, so this will only be for this year. And the Friends program, which runs typically a family shelter, year-round family shelter, said that for this year they could step in and manage the cold weather shelter. And with a lot of volunteer help, again, a lot of people have stepped up who used to volunteer at the church's shelters to volunteer again this year.
So everybody's saying, okay, thank goodness people won't be, you know, dying of hypothermia on the streets. On the other hand, Ellen, how does this work with your goal of, you know, permanent housing for people so they can get on their feet?
Well, I'd say, first of all, it's an enormous relief. It is in the wintertime. People can die outside, and we don't have, in Concord, we don't have a year-round low-barrier shelter. We have a wonderful shelter, McKenna House, which is expanding, but it is a sober house, a dry shelter, and that program works very well for some people. But there's always going to be a group of people who are suffering from addiction and need to come in from the cold. So I would say, first of all, the fact that we have those shelters is a huge relief. Our ultimate goal is permanent housing. So we don't want to take our eyes off of the permanent goal. And that's part of the risk, is that people say, phew, that's settled. People are sheltered. Now they're not homeless anymore. They're absolutely still homeless. And living in a shelter is tremendously chaotic and stressful. And so difficult to get over an addiction when you're living in that chaotic kind of environment. So we are big proponents of the Housing First model, and we're trying very hard to bring that model to Concord.
What's the challenge of that?
Oh, the challenge is funding, of course. So for Housing First to succeed, you really need a caseworker who's going to work with that person once they are housed. Someone mentioned before the rate of going back to homelessness because you're not following the rules of the lease, where you're slipping back into addiction and behaviors that are associated with that. So you need caseworker support ongoing in your permanent housing. That's the number one thing. And the number two thing is an affordable rent. And someone already mentioned that if you're on a fixed income, you really need a rental subsidy, some sort of voucher or rental assistance that's going to allow you to just pay a percentage of your income, whatever that is. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to afford the rents that we have in this state.
A couple more questions on Housing First for all of you, and then I do want to go to our listeners. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. housingfirst.org. Scott, to you, one question that sometimes comes up around Housing First is a feeling that folks should have to prove they are worthy of having the housing. You know, why should this be just given to you when others struggle so much?
I think that's a misconception that housing is just given to people. People have worked hard to even get to a position where someone would even consider them for a Housing First type of model, especially if they're a homeless individual. Our philosophy at Harbor Homes and the Partnership for Successful Living is a Housing First model, but just as Ellen said, with simultaneous case management running at the same time. In order for people to be successful in any endeavor that they choose to, whether it be educational, vocational, family reunification, you know, they need stable housing. But I think Keith's right in respect is if they're not ready for that stable housing or they don't have that support services in place when they come in, the likelihood of sustainability is affected. So I think that it's critical to have caseworkers running, you know, simultaneous tracks as Housing First goes along.
The other question that I have is, you know, I wonder if landlords would be reticent to work with you on a Housing First model, again, because the folks who might be involved in this are not clearly clean and sober and so forth.
We're very fortunate at Harbor Homes and through our statewide contacts with landlords that we have over 400 landlords that we work with statewide. Some we have very great success stories, some, you know, not necessarily successful stories along the way. But it's about bridging and communication with those landlords and building that relationship. Hard when I'm based in Nashua and I'm working with a landlord in Wolfboro, for example. It's about effective communication. It's about really effective case management and program management to make these things very successful. So from a landlord's perspective, yes, lots of education, lots of support from the organization that's providing the voucher.
Well, and Susan Ford, we heard from Keith Howard earlier giving up $40,000 in federal housing money because he does not want to move to a Housing First model. He wants to keep that sobriety model that has been so successful for him. How do you feel about Housing First?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I think in certain circumstances, if people are ready, and I think that's key. Keith mentioned that, you know, there's behaviors that need to be changed. And everybody's my bottom, I call it. My bottom was going to DHHS and applying for assistance. That was humiliating to me. It was my bottom. But my bottom is my bottom. It's not everybody else's. We've had people that we've unfortunately had to kick out of shelter for a variety of reasons. We had one that never came back, and we had to throw away her stuff. About 6 months later, she came back and asked where her stuff was, and we told her, I'm sorry. We had to throw it away. Her brother's ashes were in her stuff.
Oh, dear.
That was her bottom.
Wow.
I see her from time to time now. She works at a pizza place. She's got three part-time jobs. She's got her own apartment. And every time I see her, she says, thank you. It really sucked to lose my brother's ashes, but that's what it took. And now I have my own home. Sad story, but good. But my point is that that was her bottom. Not everybody's ready when they become homeless to make those changes that need to be made in their lives.
And sometimes you don't know what your bottom
and
is.
Sometimes
until
you don't
hard.
Know until you hit it and it's right in your face. Yep.
Well, so how does that, what you just said, shape your feelings about Housing First? That you need to be tough, that there needs to be consequences, that sometimes you need to say, no, you can't come here till you get your act together?
I think in some cases, yeah. I see a lot of clients, and unfortunately, you can call it tough love. You can call it whatever you want. But I see a lot of clients that they say this, they talk the talk, but they're not ready to walk the walk. And they want a place, and they want to say that they want a place, but they're not really ready to do the things that they need to do. And in my area, I don't have a close-knit area. I think it would be really hard to effectively case manage people that are living in multiple different units. Now, if I had a big 20-apartment building to myself and I could put them all in that one building and manage that building myself in our program and case manage them all in one place, they're not homeless. They got their own place. But that model might work better in my mind. But I see the money that it takes to run a Housing First model when they're scattered all over the place. And I'm not sure in New Hampshire that model would really work effectively given the cost.
Do you guys want to jump in? Keith, I can see you want to jump in, and Ellen, and then we'll definitely go to our listeners.
Okay. Just wanted to say that the Housing First model has been very, very successful. When it was initially applied to chronically homeless folks with mental illness, and there were tremendous resources that were available, so there was intensive case management. My concern in New Hampshire is that it would be easy to implement the model, but then not fund the model, so you end up basically with just setting people up for failure. If there were the resources so that there was going to be daily intensive case management, then I would be – I mean, it would not be for Liberty House, but I would be much more excited about it. I fear, though, it's going to be more like the closing of the state school 40 years ago or the deinstitutionalization model for folks with mental illness, where people are promised, oh, there will be community support, nothing to worry about, and instead people are out there on their own. So that's my concern. I'm not like philosophically opposed. I am practically opposed because I don't think that it's going to be funded here in this state. And then philosophically, Liberty House is going to go its own way. But in terms of the model, it's a really expensive model, but it does work when applied properly.
So given what you've seen with other major social policy shifts here in New Hampshire, Keith, you're skeptical that this would be carried out in an appropriately funded way.
I think that it sounds like pious nonsense to me because I don't think that we will adequately fund the kind of support services that are called for.
Okay. Ellen, to you and then to our listeners.
Thanks. First, I would say I don't think it's an either or. I think there are different populations of homeless people. We touched on it, family homelessness, chronic homelessness. They have different needs, different reasons that got them to be homeless, and different approaches will work. And then with individuals, different approaches are going to work. Someone could really thrive at the Liberty House, and that is exactly where they need to be. And someone else might not be able to maintain that sobriety, and that's not going to work for them. So I don't think it's either or. I think we need all these tools in the toolbox. I don't think there's a fight going on here. I think we're all trying to get to the same place.
Should Housing and Urban Development, the federal government, pull funding from agencies that won't adopt this model?
Well, I'm not certain the Liberty House's exact situation. I know that the federal government has made veterans homelessness was their first priority in their overall plan. Chronic homelessness is the second priority. So that's where their funding is going, and they are pushing the Housing First model. I'm not aware of them pulling money from anyone. You do have to apply for the money. If you don't meet their priorities, you're probably not going to get funded.
I see.
So I don't think it's so much yanking as saying, here's what we want you to do. Either do it or don't if you want our money. And I will agree that it has to be funded properly to work. And so we got money from the state for the caseworker. We have the caseworker to do the Housing First. We don't have the vouchers yet, but we've applied for federal money for the vouchers and are hoping to get 10 units by next fall. So it is difficult to piece the money together. That's the struggle we're all facing. But overall, it has been proven to cost less to a community to house someone permanently with the caseworker support for a chronically homeless person.
You're not ending up in the ER,
the jail. You know, a night in jail costs an awful lot. A night in the hospital costs a tremendous amount. So overall, to the community, it costs much. The Housing First has been shown to cost much less.
Did you jump in real quick, Keith, and then we'll go to our listeners?
I did, and I just wanted to reiterate what Ellen was saying, that it's not that the feds have pulled money. We have chosen not to apply for money because Housing First is the law or the practice of the land. But nobody has taken anything from us. We've said we're not willing to abide by these requirements, so we're not going to apply for the money. So we're not.
But the hit is still the same.
The hit is still the same. Now, if I may, instead of us being victims, we are the people who are choosing to walk away because we believe we're doing the right thing. And that's what we would like to be recognized for. So not here to complain, but instead to say we are going our own way because we believe it's proper. it does mean that we now have $40,000 less in our budget than we did last year, and would look for generous and kind-hearted folks throughout the state to contact us and to go to our website, libertyhousenh.org, in order to make a donation. And I'll stop now.
Let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Carol is calling in from Somersworth. Hi, Carol. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. So, yes, the reason I'm calling is because at the beginning of November, I knew I was going to end up homeless. I don't have a problem with alcohol. I don't have a problem with drugs. However, I am a single mother with an autistic child working for a local nonprofit, which obviously has its own budget constraints. But when I went to the Somersworth Town Hall and I explained the situation, they said, well, it sounds to me like you're choosing to be homeless. And even though I'm a food stamps recipient, they have a homeless program, they said, well, you don't qualify because you already have a job and you already have a place to live. So the bottom line boiled down to the fact that because I wasn't already homeless, I didn't qualify for services. So currently I'm living with my mother and, you know, I still have a job. I am grateful to have a roof over my head. But why isn't there enough being done in regards to preventative services, especially where I have a child with a disability?
Yeah, Carol, so kind of living on the edge and that couch surfing that we keep talking about. Scott, I'll throw this to you. Not quite homeless, but almost.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the eyes of the HUD and the federal government, she's not homeless.
So we don't need to worry about her.
Exactly. But of course we have to worry about her. I mean, this is, I think, goes back to the beginning conversation that we talked about, lack of resources for families and things. You know, we at Harbor Homes and the Partnership for Successful Living have initiated a couple of different things to try to address this. We have an Ending Homelessness Committee, which is a group of concerned citizens from our community that are raising money every year to help us with match funds for some of our permanent housing programs, and their emphasis is chronically homeless. All the new permanent housing programs coming out of HUD are emphasizing and prioritizing chronically homeless persons. So, again, this is a perfect example of someone who's not going to get in through. They're not going to get a priority on a waiting list or anything like that, and especially when waiting lists are running 7-8 years. My waiting list at Harbor Homes has almost 700 people on it.
Waiting list for apartments?
Subsidized housing, for any type of housing with a subsidy built into it, whether it be a group home environment, supervised apartment, permanent housing, you name it. For us, the other part that we do, and especially about homeless veterans that we talked about earlier, is we have a SSVF, or Support Services for Veterans and Their Families. That is a perfect example of a housing first initiative that works. But it works only for veterans and their families. Again, there's a large segment of the population that we're missing.
Well, and Carol's story sounds a little bit like yours, Susan, kind of on the edge with a child, working but not a lot of money.
Yeah, it's really tough. There are really no services out there if you don't meet those income or eligibility criteria. And unfortunately, with this mom, she does have a disabling child, and I'm not sure why she wouldn't have been eligible, not knowing her whole story, for some assistance. But if she was looking for rental assistance and couldn't maintain that rent long term, they wouldn't help her until she became homeless, unfortunately.
All right. Well, Carol, I hope that that does not happen to you. And thank you very much for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up in just a moment, more of your calls, emails, comments. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how New Hampshire communities are handling homelessness. Some of the different ideas, discussions, strategies. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests are Susan Ford, Executive Director of the Homeless Center for Stratford County, Ellen Groh, Executive Director director of the Concord Coalition to End Homelessness, Keith Howard, executive director of Liberty House, which serves veterans, and Scott Slattery, housing director for Harbor Homes, a nonprofit that provides a range of services statewide. All of you, let's go right back to our listeners, 1-800-892-6477. And Sheila joins us from Concord. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. I'm a private landlord. I just have three apartments, just one building. And we rented to a formerly homeless family. They'd been homeless right before we rented to them, under a program where an agency would pay a decreasing amount of the rent for 6 months. And so at the end of 6 months, they would be fully responsible for the rent. And I'm wondering if this is considered to be a housing first type program. And I'm also wondering whether there's been any research on this kind of a rental subsidy and how successful it's been in helping families overcome homelessness.
Okay, so that's a different model that we haven't talked about yet. Go ahead, Ellen, you first.
Yes. Sheila, I would say that's not exactly Housing First. Housing First is meant to pay somebody a subsidy for as long as they need it. So that might have been called a rapid rehousing program, which was really meant to help someone short-term who had a plan to sustain themselves going forward, which can work for certain populations need different things. So.
No, that's interesting. And again, for the public, Housing First, rapid rehousing, supportive services, it all kind of sounds the same. Do you want to talk about rapid rehousing too, Susan?
Yeah, sure. Rapid rehousing is exactly that. It is it's meant for families that are going to be experiencing homelessness or have just landed in a shelter, have some income and have like some means to make it very short term. So it's kind of a subsidy, but it's a very short term subsidy. And there's only certain things that they can pay for to get into the apartment.
Have you seen it work in Stafford County?
I have seen it work. But again, Ellen said, it's for specific people. And I can't make that point better than what Ellen said, that everybody is different and we're trying to fit square pegs into round holes if we throw everybody into Housing First. You know, some people are going to need to go to substance abuse. Some people are going to need to go to shelter. Some people are going to need to go to get mental health treatment first. And some people, Housing First is going to be an absolute perfect option for them.
Scott?
We operate a couple of rapid rehousing grants right now. And it's exactly right. It's a six-month type of window where someone's at risk or just right on that edge where that hopefully they can attain some sustainability and a meaningful housing plan moving forward. So it is exactly like I said, a temporary grant, 6 months typically.
Sheila, thank you for the call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, one of the big challenges that all of you have mentioned, but we should hone in on a little bit more, is just the cost of housing. You mentioned low-wage jobs or multiple jobs and not quite enough to piece it together. And Keith Howard, you are in the midst right now of a personal experience with trying to find very cheap housing. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, last March, Liberty House decided that the tiny homes movement, the idea of transforming small space into adequate living space, not just adequate but likable living space, had not been tried by any organization in New England, been very successful down the West Coast, going into the Southwest, into the South. But no organization in New England had tried to do this. So what we did was got an 8x20 enclosed cargo trailer, the kind of trailer that plumbers bring their equipment out to a job site in, and then spent about $3,000 in order to insulate it, put in electricity, and make it livable space. Then on June 21st, Father's Day, summer solstice, whatever, my dog and I moved into this space, living in Raymond, but in the box that had been transformed by residents at Liberty House into livable space, keeping a blog on the Liberty House website, libertyhousenh.org.
And we'll put a link on our website just in case. nhpr.org. Go ahead, Keith.
Okay. About the challenges and the joys of living in smaller space.
In a tiny home.
And the actual home that we built will be given to a former resident who prefers not to be named because he put in 150 hours of unpaid labor in transforming just an uninsulated box into very livable space. Then he's planning on taking this trailer to his hometown to try to reintegrate there, because that's something else that we have not talked about in talking about housing, is that once you get outside of the municipal – of the city at metropolitan areas, there's very little rental property of any kind. If you want, if you're from a small town north of the lake, there's nothing there unless you're a friend of a friend and things just disappear quickly.
And Lakes Region is very expensive.
Right. And so being able to have, even if it's just over the next 5 years, you know, 15 or 20 of these tiny homes that have been produced and are located throughout the state for former Liberty House residents to have access to, it's one tiny part of a solution to this big problem. Just as Ellen was talking, there is no one size fits all. This wouldn't be right for everybody. Lucy, my dog, and I having a great time in this experiment, but for some people, it would feel like being in solitary confinement.
Or in a box.
Or in a box, right.
So just real quick, and again, folks can look at the pictures on your website and so forth.
If you want to know how we go to the bathroom?
No, I wasn't going to ask you that.
That's the first question most people ask.
Because I looked at the pictures and you've got a composting toilet. But if I'm trying to get a sense of how tiny is tiny, Keith. So if I were driving down the road and I saw a Market Basket grocery store truck, you know, those big trucks that deliver groceries or a Shaw's truck or Hannaford's or whatever, is it as big as those containers on the back of the truck? Because that's sort of a standard size that most people can picture.
No, not quite.
It's smaller than that.
Smaller than that. It's 8 feet wide, which is 8 feet.
Okay.
And 20 feet long, which is, picture the 8 feet, double it and add half again. You've got 20 feet. So it's an 8x20 box.
All right.
With heat from propane heater, but there's no heat at night because I don't really trust the heating system to be safe. And while we do keep a window, you know, cracked to let in air, when I get up in the morning, Lucy's water dish is oftentimes frozen over, so I'll need to heat up water on the stove in order to be able to give her water to drink.
Well, so some challenges, but Olivia, I wonder what you think. I mean, again, Scott, one of the biggest challenges in terms of resolving this homeless problem is just finding places to live. So why not tiny homes all over the state?
I think it's a great idea. Any type of way that we can create more affordable housing in any places around the state is welcomed, especially in these smaller communities, like Keith said, that don't have lots of apartment living, rental housing, and things like that. So I think that this is an innovative way to address this.
Would that work in Concord, Ellen?
I think it could. I think it could. You'd have to find places to put them. And the legislature is working right now. I don't know where it's at. A bill about accessory buildings and allowing them as of right in your on your property. So someone who wanted to have a tiny home in their backyard as an in-law apartment or as a rental unit for anyone, that could become possible soon. So I think it's one more solution to add to the mix.
Do you want to jump back in, Keith?
I did. Just to say that local government really is the key to this. We had been planning on locating the Liberty Home in one town in southern New Hampshire, had a landowner who would who was very, very positive, but the town set up a number of roadblocks based on personal animosity going back about five generations toward the landowner, I think. But so that was one town, but we're now in Raymond, which has welcomed us and where the town manager gave, I don't want to say an edict, but sent out a directive that town employees were to do whatever they could in order to make this work instead of whatever they could to keep us out of town. So I've appeared before the Board of Selectmen, going to be speaking to them again within the next month, just giving them an update. And so the town itself has been very supportive, whereas the first town wanted nothing to do with us at all.
Well, people might have concerns about so-called homeless camps and, you know, fighting or drinking or just things that don't feel safe. So that's something that, you know, these models are going to have to get around. I mean, people have concerns for the quality of their own neighborhood.
Right.
And you've seen that all around the state when people say, let's set up a homeless shelter. You saw that in Concord, Ellen. There have been attempts over the years to set up a more permanent shelter than these temporary winter shelters that the churches ran. And folks, you know, say, look, I don't want my kids walking past that in the morning and so forth.
Right. And I think some of that is fear based on stigmas rather than any actual danger. But it exists. People's fears around what that's going to do to their neighborhood to have a homeless shelter or low-income housing, if you will. But I think a lot of it is not justified, and education is needed. There's plenty of people who are formerly homeless living all over the place that no one knows about, and they're not bothering anyone. So,
what do you think about that, Susan? The concern that, you know, having a homeless shelter in your neighborhood is not compatible with having a quote-unquote good neighborhood.
I think it's like anything else. There's always going to be one or two people that cause a problem that end up making it problematic for the rest of the population that don't cause a problem. In my experience at the shelter...
Have you had to deal with that?
I've been there 5 years, and I think I've had one person that was maybe potentially going to be violent if I didn't calmly diffuse the situation at that point. 5 years after serving close to 500 people, it's a very small piece of the grand scheme. And I would hate for anybody to come into my shelter and say, you have to close because that person caused a problem. One person out of almost 500.
Talking about public concerns, and Scott, I'll throw this to you. What about concerns that if a community, you know, steps up, does a good job taking care of homeless folks, sets up a system of shelters, works on housing first, and then some people say, wait a minute, you know, that attracts people in need of these services and is going to overburden our city or town. So if a particular community does, quote unquote, too good a job, you kind of become a victim of your own success. I wonder what you think about that, Scott.
So we're talking about if we build it, they will come. They're already here, Laura. They're already here. And especially in larger communities like Manchester and Nashville, where most of the social service agencies are centrally located, they're coming every day. I get 15 to 20 phone calls every day. We're being evicted. We're losing our housing. We need a subsidy. It goes back to a lack of affordable housing and a lack of a livable wage, two things that we've talked about here, you know, this morning.
When you say coming, though, do you mean coming from elsewhere, or do you mean coming within that community due to those circumstances that you
They're mentioned. Coming from within the community. I mean, look at the Nashua area. They come from Milford. They come from Hudson. They come from Merrimack. They come from the surrounding communities like that because that's where the hub of services are in Nashua. Manchester, the same thing. They come from Goffstown. They come from Auburn or Candy or some of the surrounding smaller communities where there aren't other services. They connect with someone in their community and they say, oh, call Liberty House, call Harbor Homes, call the shelter, that type of thing. That's what I mean when they come.
Do those smaller communities have a responsibility to take care of their own, so to speak, instead of, quote unquote, sending them to Nashua or Manchester?
Absolutely. The state law actually requires it, that each, if you're poor and unable to support yourself within your community, that your town has, you know, a responsibility to assist you. Does that mean connecting you up with some services? It could be. It could mean putting you in a motel on a short-term basis. It could mean a variety of different things. But people gravitate towards where the services are.
Ellen, this has come up in Concord. Big issue. People say Concord does too good a job taking care of the homeless, and it's making us a quote-unquote magnet.
I think every city would say that they feel like they're a magnet. Every city has their own unique circumstance that says this is why people are coming here. In Concord, people do talk about the fact that we have the state mental health hospital here and the state prison. And when people are released from there, maybe they do stay in Concord. But I would say each of these small towns does have an obligation and a responsibility. But the jobs are in the cities. The rental apartments are in the cities. Services are in the cities. So there's only so much that that each individual town can do.
We talked earlier about one of the success stories in this overall picture, and Scott, I'll throw this to you, does have to do with veterans' homelessness. Keith mentioned Michelle Obama has made this a priority. Did you want to add in on efforts here in New Hampshire to try to keep veterans off the streets? What did you call it, Keith? Functional zero.
Functional zero. I didn't call it.
Yes, that's the term. Go ahead, Scott.
No, functional zero is an absolute priority for our organization. We provide grant and per diem housing, a lot of different veterans programs as well, and we don't want to hear, we don't want to know about any homeless veteran in our entire state. So I invite anyone and everyone, if you're aware of a homeless veteran, please call us at Harbor Homes in Nashua, 882-3616, or the website harborhomes.org or newhampshirepartnership.org. Get us in touch with these people. We want to offer, make an offer of housing in one of the different ways for our veterans, yes.
Susan, last question for you. Again, we keep referring back to this 2015 report. What do you think we're going to see a year from now? You care to make a prediction, if we sat down next year around this time, what we would say about 2016?
Well, I think we're still going to see homelessness. I think we're still going to see low-wage jobs, unfortunately. I think we're going to see a lack of transportation. I think we're going to see, hopefully, more people coming together and talking about more solutions, because I don't think that any one solution is the key solution. I think that it's going to take multiple different types of answers to create functional zero for all people.
Susan, thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Susan Ford, Executive Director of the Homeless Center for Stratford County. Ellen Groh, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Ellen Groh, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition to End Homelessness. Keith Howard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Keith Howard, Executive Director of Liberty House, which serves veterans. And Scott Slattery, thank you also for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Scott Slattery, Housing Director for Harbor Homes. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy. We'll